Our sun is headed into solar maximum, the period of greatest activity in its solar cycle. My name is Troy Klein, and welcome to the new podcast series called Space Weather Living History. During this series, you'll hear directly from the people who for years have been studying the evolution of space weather, how we make observations, and our capabilities to predict space weather events. Now, every 11 years on average, our sun reaches a peak period of activity called solar maximum. That's followed a few years later by a period of quiet called solar minimum. During solar maximum, there are many sunspots, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections, all of which can affect communications and technology here on Earth. Now, the energy from those solar blasts can disrupt radio communications, upset electrical power systems, damage satellites and change their orbits, cause navigational equipment to make mistakes, and even endanger astronauts walking in space. The effects from these solar storms can be far-reaching. In fact, they can have impacts throughout our entire solar system. These conditions are what we refer to as space weather. Sound exciting? Let's get right to the next interview.
I'm Don Fairfield, and I've been working in the field of magnetospheric physics for many years. I was sort of in on the beginning of it. I know when I was taking my first physics course in college in 1957, Sputnik was launched. And when I graduated from college, I was offered an assistantship at Penn State, and I went to Penn State and to work in the ionosphere research lab there. And this was 1960, and the next year they offered me the opportunity to work with Jim Dungey, who was a consultant at Penn State, and he would come visit a couple of times a year. And I accepted their invitation to do this, and he was my third thesis advisor for my 5 years at Penn State. In 1961, he published what I think most people will admit is probably the most important paper in space sciences. And for my master's thesis at Penn State, he had me looking at high-latitude magnetograms, data from the IGY, because he had an idea of how the currents might be driven by the solar wind. And after completing that master's thesis, he gave me a problem for my PhD thesis, which in retrospect, I think was maybe the best thesis project anybody ever had. His idea was that the magnetosphere was controlled by the interplanetary magnetic field, and it would operate differently depending on whether the interplanetary field was northward or when it was southward. And because when it was southward, then the currents would be driven in the magnetosphere, aurora would be produced, and it was a very significant theory. And his idea was that I could look at the magnetic field data. And at that time, the first satellite to orbit the Earth and make measurements outside of the magnetosphere was Explorer 12. And he arranged for me to go to the University of New Hampshire and work with Larry Cahill, who was the experimenter on the magnetic field experiment. And I went to New Hampshire for the summer of 1964 and looked at this data. It was an interesting experience. When I arrived there, the halls were completely filled with bookshelves of printout of his data, because before this time he had worked with rocket data, where you have maybe just a few minutes of data on one rocket flight. And now he suddenly had day after day, month after month of satellite data. In his experiment, may measured the magnetic field three times every second. So he was overwhelmed with this data, and he had some students with mechanical calculators computing averages of this 3-second data. And while some other people were working trying to get the data onto a modern, at that time, computer. Anyway, that was a very profitable summer, and indeed, the magnetograms that I was using to detect the magnetic field activity was clearly enhanced when the interplanetary field was southward. I remember thinking, is research always this easy? Because it did just seem very, very apparent that his ideas were correct. After finishing my degree at Penn State, I accepted a postdoctoral position at NASA Goddard, working with Norman Ness. And Norman then had the best solar wind data of anybody at that time, with his data from the interplanetary monitoring platform. So my first goal was to try to provide a statistical support for my earlier work. To do that, I needed a measure of the magnetic activity, which was better than the 3-hour KP averages. And at that time, Davis Segura had published a paper defining what they called the AE, or Auroral Electrojet Index. And this was just what I needed for statistical work. So I worked with the data center at Goddard and started computing this AE index on a regular basis. And then I went on to compare it with the larger data set from IMP spacecraft. And indeed, that did confirm the association with southward field and magnetic activity. And that work I then published in a Proceedings of the COSPAR meeting, I think in 1967. And I think that was the least referenced paper I ever published, because this is a rather obscure journal. I never bothered to publish it in a real journal. This was just proceedings of a meeting. Yeah, back in these early days, when spacecraft were being launched quite frequently, it was really very exciting, because every spacecraft went to a different region and found new things. It was not like the situation is today, where you make incremental advances, but you were discovering really new and unexpected things at that point. When I first came to Goddard, Norman Ness sort of turned over the analysis of the IMP-2 spacecraft to me. And this spacecraft was actually called a failure by NASA headquarters, because the apogee was only about 16 Earth radii, whereas they had meant for it to go out about twice as far, where it would survey the solar wind and its magnetic field. But in fact, 16 Earth radii was an excellent orbit for studying the magnetosphere, and it took many, many years before there was another satellite in that very important region. The nice thing about the IMP satellites was that they, going out to typically 30 Earth radii, they covered all regions of the magnetosphere. So I felt very fortunate in being able to work in all these different regions where the spacecraft traversed. One of the early things I did was to map out the positions of the magnetopause and the bow shock. Explorer 12 had really mapped the magnetosphere pretty well. It went out to 13 Earth radii, but that wasn't far enough out to see the bow shock. So a lot of the early work on IMP was done at the bow shock, and I went through and determined the various crossings on each orbit, and published a paper which really delineated the position of the bow shock and the magnetopause, which was of considerable interest to people who would follow, because it's important to know where these basic structures were located. I also used the early magnetic field IMP2 data to study the configuration of the magnetic field, and particularly how the solar wind compressed the data on the day side and then extended the data on the night side. Because it was just before that time that Norman Ness, with his IMP1 data, had discovered the magneto tail. And of course, the configuration of the magnetosphere is important, because that controls where the particles go. So this was of considerable interest. At that time, the conventional wisdom was that nothing could propagate outward from the bow shock, at least no magnetic field waves could propagate outward from the bow shock, because the wave propagation speed was less than the incoming solar wind speed. But in looking at the data, it was clear that there were waves upstream of the bow shock. And this was a surprise, but I was able to use IMP data to show that the location of these waves upstream from the bow shock depended on what the interplanetary direction was. It was on one side of the magnetosphere when the magnetic field was directed one direction, and on the other side if the magnetosphere were directed another direction. And this, in fact, was really the first determination of the foreshock, as it was later called, which has been much studied in later years. And it became, of course, the question was, how do these waves exist upstream when they're not, don't have high enough velocities to propagate upstream? And I remember going over to the University of Maryland and talking to Derek Tidman, and it was his suggestion that it was particles moving upstream from the bow shock which could generate these waves in the upstream region. And this is something that I think has held up over the years, and much, very much more data has been done on the foreshock since then. When I was in graduate school, the field of plasma physics was only just beginning. At Penn State, they didn't teach a course in plasma physics because the field was so new. So I felt very fortunate over the years in learning my plasma physics by seeing it in action, you might say, because of course this whole interaction of the solar wind with the magnetosphere is all plasma physics. I remember at one point, when we had IMPs 1 and 2 flying at the same time, I was able to see features in the interplanetary magnetic field, first at the spacecraft further upstream and then at the spacecraft nearer to the Earth. And this was clear evidence of how the magnetic field is convected with the solar wind. And this was, a pretty well-accepted idea at that point, but I don't think anybody had ever observed it. So it was interesting in being able to see something that was predicted by the theory. I remember in another case, I was doing some early work on the Earth's bow shock, and I was able to determine that there were waves standing on the bow shock itself. And this was a phenomenon that was on the cover of an early book on plasma physics and shock physics. So it was very interesting to see something in real life that had been predicted by theory. Since the magnetic field controls all particle motion, it was of interest to have a model of the field which represented the distortions of the magnetic field and the fact that the field was no longer a dipole field, but was distorted by the solar wind. So at some point, I collected data from a number of IMPS satellites in the magnetosphere, and then I worked with Gilbert Meade at Goddard, and we came up with the first quantitative model of the distorted magnetic field. We used Gil Meade's experience in modeling fields with the data to create this realistic model of the magnetic field. And of course, subsequently, many people went on to produce more sophisticated models, but that was useful as a start. In later years, I did further work on the foreshock. I realized that many of the perturbations in the upstream region were magnetic field compressions. And this was different than what is seen in the unperturbed solar wind. So it was evidence that something was happening in the foreshock, and then these density perturbations would be convected through the bow shock and impinge on the magnetosphere and create compressions of the magnetosphere. And this was apparent in the data and was a new phenomenon at that time. Subsequently, much further work has been done on the foreshock and how it affects the Earth, but this was one of the early evidences for it. At a later time, I again used IMP data to notice that there were very significant waves on the magnetopause surface, and I worked with Antonios Otto at the University of Alaska, and we realized that these were Kelvin-Helmholtz waves. Kelvin-Helmholtz instability had been well known, but it had not been seen on the magnetopause until this time. But with Antonius's theoretical expertise and the IMP data, we were able to demonstrate that this was occurring at the magnetopause.
I hope you enjoyed the Space Weather Living History podcast brought to you by NASA's Sun Earth Days program. You can learn more about the Space Weather Living History project on our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. And don't forget to join our growing community of Facebook and Twitter fans for the latest information and facts about the new Sun Earth Day themes. For all other details about these programs, including information about our past Sun Earth Days themes, be sure to visit our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov.
This is Troy Klein signing off.